Well, to at least put the synopsis question, there are two of them actually, on the overhead so that you can copy those and get started on them. And then you'll have the actual questions Tuesday. I'm very sorry about that, but I just had not anticipated what was happening and didn't get them finished. Glad to see those of you who are here. If your getting here was as harried as mine, you deserve a real round of applause just for being here. But I've always, maybe it's just that I grew up in this part of the country, but I always like these mornings because, in fact, if you tie it in with Hauerwas, there is an element of adventure in driving in the snow. And I, to this day, although it gets a little more threatening as you get older, because you don't, if you fall or slip, or you're just not as agile as you were, but I used to just love it when you didn't quite know whether you were going to get home or not, or make it, and had to try your best skill against the snow. We used to live the first 12 or 13, 14 years I was in Ithaca, we lived on a hill that not only was quite steep, but also slanted from the left to the right. So you had two different vectors you were working against, and it was really, really tricky. And you felt quite good about yourself if you were able to make it, particularly if you saw cars floundering all over without making it. But part of the fun of that has also been taken away, as I'm sure you know, by the front-wheel drive cars, because it's so much easier to get through the snow. With some of the rear-wheel drives, it used to be just awful, as you probably know if you've driven them. Okay, let me continue from where we left off on Tuesday. I was talking about teleological theories of ethics, and I want to go on and talk about deontological theories, and here I had another glitch getting to the office late. I did not find the sheet where I had this written out, so I'll spell that for you. Deontological is deontological. It's deontological theories. And this term comes from the Greek terms deon, deon, or deontos, deontos. And these terms refer to that which is binding or needful or right, that which binds you to act in a certain way. Deontological theories are not oriented towards maximizing the good, such as in utilitarianism, but they're oriented towards one or more principles of what is the right or correct thing to do. The golden rule would be a kind of deontological principle. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or in some forms, sometimes you've heard the reference to the silver rule, don't do unto others what you wouldn't have them do unto you. I once had a political science professor who had been a congressman for some years, and he coined what he called the aluminum rule. He said it was more useful for politics than either the golden or silver rules. The aluminum rule was don't let others do unto you what you wouldn't do unto them. But anyway, a deontological approach starts with some principle of what is right, what one ought to do, irregardless of consequences. Kant's categorical imperative, which has various forms, but in one form, argues that we should always treat people as ends, not means. We should not use people just for our own benefit. The deontologist argues that it is possible for an action to be morally right or binding upon one, even when it does not promote the greatest possible balance of good over evil, whether for yourself or for society as a whole. Some today would, for instance, want to include the welfare of animals in that kind of judgment. It may be right or obligatory simply because of the way the world is or something in the principle itself. And usually, deontological principles such as those formulated by the philosopher Immanuel Kant, usually they make a claim to universality in a similar way to what Bentham and John Stuart Mill and others made for utilitarianism. That is, the maximizing of the good is binding upon all of us, not just some of us, depending on a place or time. So Kant was looking for universal principles that were binding on all. Now, both of these, the teleological and the deontological, are really quite familiar to us. Sometimes we do think in utilitarian terms quite clearly, and at other times we have a sense that it's simply wrong to ask about what the immediate outcome. We are sense that we're obligated to do something because we promise to do it, even though it's inconvenient, and so on. We don't make that kind of calculus. Under utilitarianism, strictly conceived, I'm not referring to some of the later forms of utilitarianism, such as rule utilitarianism, but strictly conceived, utilitarianism could justify enslaving some for the benefit of others. Deontology never could justify such a situation. That would violate a kind of basic principle, even though you might maximize the total good by using some people, let's say, as slaves. Now, a third kind of ethical theory that has been prominent is what we sometimes refer to as social contract theories. This is an approach to philosophical ethics that involves what has been called the contract. The most prominent contemporary social contract theorist is John Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, a philosopher at Harvard, and his most famous writing is his book done in the early 70s, A Theory of Justice. And Rawls argues, as contract theorists have, going all the way back to Locke, for instance, that we ought to try to see what kind of a society would emerge if we, in Rawls's case, make a kind of hypothetical contract. He says, let's imagine that there is an original position where you don't know who you will be once this system is put into effect, when you will live, what status in life you will occupy, what role. You go back to an original position and try to reflect under what he calls a veil of ignorance. That is, you're ignorant of who, when, where you will yourself be situated. And under these conditions, what kind of a social contract would you imagine to be the most just? This is a little bit like, obviously in a very much more sophisticated form, the ploy that some parents use to let one child cut the pieces of pie and then get the last choice. And if you're cutting and know you have the last choice, you probably will cut them somewhat more evenly than if you cut and know you have the first choice. It's a version of that approach. And Rawls develops this into particularly a political philosophy. He's modified this somewhat. His earlier writing seemed to be somewhat more broadly extended, but in his later writings, as he received criticisms for the theory of justice, he narrowed this more and more to a political concept of justice as fairness. So in one sense, it's not quite correct to compare Rawls with, say, either Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill as utilitarians, or with Immanuel Kant as a deontologist, because Rawls increasingly has focused his attention on what kind of a political agreement would work best in a highly pluralistic democratic society. And the key term here is the term justice as fairness. He argues that in a society such as our own, a liberal democratic society, the state does not have the right to foster comprehensive doctrines, is the term he uses. The state ought to leave that up to individuals and groups and churches and private organizations and so on. The state shouldn't foster a particular vision of the good life. It ought rather to focus on the political arrangement to guarantee justice to all the various participants who then will make their own choices about the nature of the good life. They will choose their own worldview or comprehensive doctrine as they see fit. This is a limited view, then, of justice. Rawls has been criticized by many. Some of the criticisms, I think, make sense. Some, perhaps, are less effective. Some have argued that the whole construct of the hypothetical original position under the veil of ignorance presupposes a number of things. It presupposes, for one thing, that people are not risk takers. It wouldn't work very well if people in the original position were risk takers and said, well, let's have a fair amount of difference in what benefits one might receive from this arrangement, and let's gamble on the fact that we'll come out better than someone else. Also, other critics have pointed out that, as a matter of fact, this may simply be too artificial. All of us do, as a matter of fact, know who we are and where we're situated and so on, and to try to get back to this kind of pure hypothetical may be more than we are able to do. Now, some of the social contract positions are more broadly ethical, that is, they do not focus in just on the political, as does John Rawls. I think whatever one thinks of his position, it's a powerful position, and it seems to me that one can hardly do any serious thinking about politics or social justice and so on without taking Rawls into account. I find the position very attractive in many respects when it is narrowed to a concept of political justice. I find it less attractive if you try to take a similar kind of arrangement and broaden it out to the field of ethics more generally. Now, one of the things that we have learned in the area of philosophical ethics, although I'm not sure this always comes through clear enough in introductory courses, it's my judgment that very, very seldom does anyone function purely within a utilitarian or deontological or social contract framework. My sense is that most often we function with some combination of these different ways of approaching moral reality. And it's very, very easy to take borderline situations. I've given you the situation of the SS troops knocking on your door just after you've hidden some Jewish friends in the fruit cellar, and have you seen them, and so on. Do you lie about it, or do you tell the truth, what does it mean to tell the truth, and so on. And that attempt to deal with, in this case, what truth-telling means might by some seem to be a kind of fudging on the basic principle, one ought always to tell the truth. And in one sense it is, and that may simply indicate that it's not possible to lead a fully moral life just on the basis of a single universal principle. My own position is that it clearly is not. On the other hand, one can at least to some degree rescue a deontological approach one ought always to tell the truth, by redefining, in this case, what truth-telling means. A similar type of example, and philosophers concoct rather weird examples. I hope you understand the principle there. If someone says there is no X or no Y, and you can produce at least one case of X or Y, then that first judgment has to be revised. So if you want to show that there's at least one case of X or Y, you don't take the vague or ambiguous or subtle cases. You go right for the clearest case you can get. And that's why some of the paradigmatic examples of evil that include genocide or include just willful torture or something of this sort are often used by philosophers, not because they think that that's the way most of us experience life, but because if you're trying to establish the principle and someone says, no, the principle is wrong, and you can show at least one case where it is that judgment is false, then you're at least able to talk further about the issue. And the kind of situation you often get is, imagine, and sometimes after one's worked in the field long enough, you can't remember whether these are your own examples or whether somewhere 30 years ago you read them. So in this case, I honestly can't. But imagine a rather bizarre scene. Someone says one ought never to kill another human being. And I think probably a fair number of you believe that. I grew up as a pacifist. Imagine a scene where, let's say, a Vietnam War veteran is sitting on the in his little apartment up on the 20th story of an apartment building, and he has his rifle from the war sitting right nearby. And as he's looking out, he sees in the playground on the other side of the street below that a madman has come along with a club and is clubbing children to death, is just bashing them, and there's no one else around to help them. And let's further imagine that he has just one bullet in his gun, and that he's a good shot, but he's not good enough to aim for the madman's leg or arm to incapacitate him. He has to, if he's going to stop him, aim right for the chest. Now, should he shoot the man or not? Well, I don't think there's an easy answer to that kind of question. I think some could argue, as many Quakers would and Mennonites and other pacifists, that in the long run, it is still better not to kill ever another human being. We should not have capital punishment. We should not agree to participate in warfare. But on the other hand, one could make a fairly strong argument, I would guess, and that would also go along with the moral sentiments of many of us, that for the war veteran here to try to stop the madman by aiming right for the chest and likely killing him would have a fair amount of justification, too. This is the kind of situation. Now, how would that fit within a deontological framework? I think probably, if the deontologist would argue that that was permitted, it would be along the same lines as the truth-telling case. That is, you would say that the entire situation was so false that you were undergirding or living up to your principle of not killing precisely by killing. In this case, it's far less convincing to me. I think in the truth-telling case, you really can make a reasonably plausible case that by telling the lie, or by telling the truth literally, you are complicit in a far greater lie. In this case, at least from my own way of thinking about it, it's harder somehow to say, well, this really isn't killing, or this is a different kind of act because of the circumstances. But these are the kinds of things that moral theorists work with all the time. And my own position is that you cannot adequately understand the complexity of moral existence with any one principle. I just don't think it's possible to have a universal principle that works for everyone in every situation. And I would also remind you of the fact that most of us do not face these extremely difficult situations. Most of us find that the difficulty of the moral life is not these hugely problematic situations, but it's the day-by-day living with reasonable fairness and concern and so on for other people. I'm reminded of a comment that Mark Twain once made. He said, it's not what I don't understand in the Bible that troubles me, it's what I do understand. Most of us, I think, have enough problem thinking about how we act fairly and so on in the everyday than these very, very far out philosophical, ethical problems such as the two or three that I have mentioned. Now, much moral discourse today focuses on the term right or rights. Let me give a definition from the Encyclopedia of Philosophy. We could have other definitions, but Stanley Benn writes, he says, human rights, in short, are statements of basic needs or interests. They are politically significant as grounds of protest and justification for reforming policies. They differ from appeals to benevolence and charity in that they invoke ideals like justice and equality. A man with a right has no reason to be grateful to benefactors. He has grounds for grievance when it is denied. The concept presupposes a standard below which it is intolerable that a human being should fall, not just in the way that cruelty to an animal is not to be tolerated, but rather that human deprivations affront some ideal conception of what a human life ought to be like, a conception of human excellence. Now, that's interesting in another respect, that is that it's somewhat dated, because there are various ethical theorists today who would say, yes, we have to also include animal rights in this, and it couldn't be phrased in just that way. But I find the term right a very, very interesting term, because on the one hand, we can use it in a fairly straightforward legal political sense. If the law says you have certain benefits that are due you or certain things that you can expect and require of others, it's fairly easy to see the chain of obligation in terms of the law enforced by the state. That's fairly straightforward. You have a right to freedom of speech and freedom of religion under the Constitution, for instance, or freedom of assembly or freedom of press. The problem becomes more complex when we try to think of a right as something more nearly inherent in reality itself. When we use the concept of moral rights to argue against a particular set of laws, we say those laws are unjust because they do not respect human rights. And if you look at a group that has been extremely active and has had a tremendous record in this area, such as Amnesty International, they will often criticize the legal political situation and the rights associated with that from a larger human understanding of rights. Now, what intrigues me particularly about this is that more and more the language of public discourse has been pushed into the direction of rights talk. We don't talk, incidentally, all that much today, or not nearly as much, about duty and responsibility. But when you really reflect on what a moral right would be, it also inevitably entails the fact that if you have a right, someone else has a duty, and vice versa. Rights are not just freestanding. Someone else has to keep her side of the bargain, so to speak. But I'm also intrigued with the fact that we have increasingly pushed religiously grounded ethics out of the public discussion on the basis that these somehow entail faith, not reason. Whereas if you really think about the term right or rights, it seems to me at least that we have to recognize the fact that these also are objects of faith. You can't see a right, you can't a moral right, you can't taste it or measure it, you can't point to here it is. A right in this philosophical moral sense is a kind of statement of an ideal and then the implications that ideal has for human interaction. And I think that's very helpful to keep that in mind, because a very large part of what I assume in doing this course is that the way we have tended to argue about the relationship between belief, between faith and reason is misguided. I had an interesting conversation with the TAs, I think it was on Tuesday or recently. Jim Tantillo was saying that often he gets a sense from students that you think that I'm trying to turn the clock back to some earlier stage, more religious, more based on faith, less interested in reason, and so on. And Jim said, you know, that's interesting, because what you're really doing in many ways is much closer to postmodernism than to pushing the clock back. What I'm really doing in this course, to a considerable extent, is arguing that the way many secular philosophers have argued from the time of the Enlightenment on, that there is one rational, reasonable, universal way to think about moral obligation and political responsibility and so on, I think that that kind of position has been largely blown out of the water by philosophical and epistemological developments of the last 30 or 40 years. That is, I think the belief that the secular ethicist or philosopher is uniquely rational, whereas other people do it by faith, just doesn't work. This obviously came out in the articles you read in the second week. And in a sense, that's not trying to turn the clock back. That's trying to push ahead a little faster, arguing that there are many philosophers and ethicists who haven't yet really dealt adequately with the fact that as human beings, we simply cannot rightly claim that kind of objectivity and pure rationality. And that's one of the reasons why I've assigned the kind of material that we are reading this week. It seems to me that the Hauerwas readings are one attempt to strike a middle position between utter subjectivism and irrationalism, and on the other side, a kind of rationalism that says there is a single, uniquely, rationally compelling principle that can guide our moral existence. I think that kind of position simply does not make much sense anymore. And that's one of the reasons I call your attention to how we use terms like right and rights, because somehow that seems more rational to talk about rights than it does, for instance, to talk about maybe some principles out of Talmud or out of the New Testament or whatever. I'm not convinced in the long run that it is, particularly when you have the kind of multiplication of rights that we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years. Today, practically any time somebody wants something badly enough, they claim that they have a right to it, and the rest of us, although that isn't quite said in that way, have the duty to provide it. And it seems to me that it's very, very hard to argue that that is somehow a uniquely rational approach. Jim, did you have a question? I think that that is the case to some degree. I take the kind of legal rights that we have in the Constitution very, very seriously. I think these are utterly formative and utterly basic to who we are as a people. And if you, alongside of these, use the same term to refer to some ridiculous claim, maybe everyone has a right to a swimming pool or to whatever, I think that you're really weakening those more fundamental rights that are an integral part of the social contract or the political compact. I take those rights that we have agreed upon as formative and so on very, very seriously. And even though they also represent ideals and so on. Now, I don't mean by that that we never can add anything to the Constitution. I think it is right or correct that from time to time we amend the Constitution as our political, moral understanding shifts. But I think there was wisdom in the way the founders put this together, that this ought to be done sparingly, and they made it somewhat difficult to do. This ought to represent a fairly broad consensus when we move in that direction. So I think your question, which was a kind of comment, is very appropriate. Okay, let me just say a few words here. I wish we had really 2 or 3 weeks to work with this. I believe that it's often the case in talking about ethics that we take far too little time to talk about the historical situation in which we do ethics and the historical situation out of which many of our moral insights have arisen. For instance, I found it very fruitful, as I've thought about environmental ethics, to focus on some of the basic insights of what we might call traditional English liberalism. And again, I remind you that I'm here using the term in the generic sense in which both conservatives and liberals with small c and l are part of liberalism in the broader sense. The fact that this way of approaching ethics and politics makes the assumption that reason is largely in the service of passion or desire, that rational behavior is largely self-interested behavior, that if you act rationally, you will maximize your own self-interest. In fact, C.B. McPherson, writing as a kind of neo-Marxist, argues that we'll not only maximize our self-interest, he sees in this even a kind of acquisitive behavior. The focus on rights, on justice, but a refusal to define the good, a very heavy emphasis on one's preferences and desires. I think that English liberalism grew up in a time when there was a sense of the unlimited possibilities that we had. It was a time of perceived growth and increased freedom, the discovery of the new world. All of these, I believe, are important for how they've influenced our thinking. And I am fairly critical of that approach, although at the same time, it seems to me, as I indicated in an earlier lecture, that English liberalism played a very important and useful role in Western culture in helping us break free from some of the poorer aspects of feudal society. It was a very liberating philosophy. People did not have to get stuck in the particular role or status to which they were born. There was a very exhilarating sense of expanded opportunity, of the power of reason to overthrow dead tradition, a wonderful sense of newness and opportunity in world exploration, the concept of America, all that it meant to Europeans and so on. And I think in those senses, English liberalism needs to be seen as having unleashed a period of enormous creativity in the Western world, creating societies where the great majority of people had a reasonably decent standard of living, which was really in many respects unheard of in earlier history except in very small limited societies. This was a way of thinking coupled with the emergence of modern science that unleashed a great deal of energy and freedom and so on. John Locke's theory of property from his second treatise of government, published in 1690, contained the kind of thinking that I think made possible the rise of modern capitalism and some of the energies that that also released, some of which we clearly see have also been very destructive. But Locke, you'll remember, in his thinking about property, argued that each person is master of himself, which is already an interesting departure, because the more traditional Christian or Jewish way of framing this is that ultimately each of us belongs to God. I mentioned that the major argument against suicide was you didn't have the right to destroy someone else's property. But Locke argues that each of us is master of himself. We possess ourselves absolutely. People have a right to self-preservation and thus to the things they need for their subsistence. And he argues that through a man's labor, he removes things from what he calls, quote, the state of nature. Locke goes on to argue, and I think here we have also some of the driving power of the whole concept of technology and development. Locke argues that apart from human labor, nature itself or the things of the earth have only very little value. But when a man, quote, mixes his labor, unquote, with the land, when he puts his energy into developing nature, these things have greater value and they become his own property. For instance, there may be nut trees or banana trees in the state of nature, and as long as nobody picks them or spends any time cultivating or improving them, they belong to everyone. But when a person mixes his labor with these banana trees or nut trees, cultivates and improves them and picks the bananas and so on, they become his own. But Locke qualifies this by adding two provisos. The first was that a person ought only to take so much as he could use. It was not right, Locke argued, to let things go to waste or spoil. You shouldn't pick so many bananas that they just sit there and rot. That seemed obviously misguided. And secondly, this process of making something your own property by mixing your labor with it is valid only, quote, where there are enough and as good left in common for others. You shouldn't take so much for yourself that others are destitute. Now, the first proviso only so much as I'm sorry, the second proviso, he argued, this is easy to meet because of all the undeveloped land in England, and also he referred at times to America. And it's very hard for us today to understand how America functioned almost as a kind of dream or a kind of ideal, a land of opportunity and freedom, already back in Locke's time. But here it was clearly the case. He argued that there was enough left over for others. There was plenty of land to develop. That wasn't, incidentally, altogether true, I think, at all, because already in his time, by far the best land in England had already been developed. There was not a great surplus of land, and America was not a very real possibility for most people. But then he gets around the second proviso, or the first proviso, you should take only so much as you could use. It isn't right to have things spoil, by arguing that we have the invention of money, and with money you can trade your surplus for gold, and gold doesn't spoil. Now, I find that rather disingenuous, and I have always been troubled by that way of arguing it, because it does permit the kind of amassing of wealth that I think is both good and bad. It permits the amassing of capital, which permits all kinds of productive activity, but also it permits a small minority to gain great wealth, perhaps at the expense of others. Now, to get a sense of how different Locke was from the received tradition, from the conventional wisdom that had prevailed for well over 1,000 years before Locke, maybe closer to 2 millennia, just contrast, for instance, his way of thinking with a statement, for instance, by St. Augustine, who says, "Find out how much God has given you, and from it take what you need. The remainder which you do not need is needed by others. The superfluities of the rich are the necessities of the poor. He who retains what is superfluous possesses the goods of others." Now, that is a very radical statement. That's at least as radical as any Marxist view of economic goods. If you have more than you need and others are in need, you're a thief and a robber. And you have a moral obligation to share. St. Thomas Aquinas, writing sometime after that, going back to Aristotle and embracing Aristotle's thinking within his own Christian framework, argued in favor of private property. He said it really has certain advantages. You don't quarrel as much about things, and it's easier to, you're more likely to take good care of it and so on if there is private property. But he argued that as to the use of that property, we ought to consider all things as being held in common. That is, if your neighbor has a greater need to things that you own than you do yourself, your neighbor has a certain moral claim to your possessions, you have a moral obligation to help that person in need. Now, these clearly are communitarian beliefs that are very, very different from John Locke. You can go all the way back to the Jewish scriptures, the Christian Old Testament, and see things like the Jubilee year, where all ancestral land, apart from urban land, was to be returned to the original owners and their heirs, debts were to be remitted, and so on. You also had the concept of the Sabbath year. Here were very radical concepts of distributive justice that were highly communitarian. This is also true for early Christian thinking. You had similar views, and thus it's not surprising that Augustine and can write as he does, or that St. Thomas Aquinas can feel so comfortable embracing a basically Aristotelian position. But notice the enormous change with John Locke and the rise of English liberalism. Here is a system that focuses much more on the individual autonomous self, on maximizing your own self-interest. You act rationally if you pay attention to your own self-interest, and so on and so on. Now, I think that the environmental implications of that in some ways are very, very serious indeed. The time of John Locke was a time when people had this tremendous sense of progress, infinity, unlimited horizons, the new world, use things, develop them, get rich. And as I've indicated, it was a time that unleashed enormous cultural creative energy in the Western world. The downside of it, of course, is that on the one hand, that's not the kind of world we live in. We live in a finite world with limited, finite resources, and there aren't an unending supply of Americas to be discovered. And we need to develop a way of thinking about morality that takes account of the limitedness of human existence and of our natural resources. And on the other hand, it is my conviction, at least, that the hyper-individualism, the focus on rationality equaling self-interest, and that reason is in the service of passion or desire, that also seems to me as a kind of ultimately dangerous, explosive way of thinking about the world in which we live and ourselves and how we treat it. I am much more drawn at this point to various communitarian ways of thinking that develop a sense of responsibility and loyalty to neighbor, to land, to the larger world around us. And that also is one of the reasons I wanted you to look at the material from Stanley Hauerwas and his development, particularly of some of the thinking of Iris Murdoch. It's interesting because Iris Murdoch is not a theist. She's a humanist, perhaps even an atheist. Hauerwas is clearly a Christian. But as Christians often have done, and people from other religious traditions, he finds her thinking on these particular issues extremely attractive and borrows and redevelops and enlarges many of her insights. But here's a very, very different way of thinking about moral reality and human existence. And it seems to me that it is utterly tragic that in most of our modern secular universities, students simply are not exposed to ideas like this. I think that the narrowness of doing ethics and thinking about environmental ethics only in terms of philosophical ethics is really tragic, because I think it cuts us off from the society in which we live, which embraces a wide variety of ways of approaching ethics, and it leaves us, I think, much more vulnerable to some of the dangerous aspects of English liberalism. I think a good deal of moral reflection in our own day still basically lives with the focus on the autonomous self and the equation that rational behavior is self-interested behavior. In my more negative moments, I think it's trying to make of all of us a nation of petite bourgeois Swiss shopkeepers, you know, with our account books and adding up all the profit and gain. And I don't want to be too negative towards the Swiss. That's my own background, so maybe I can take that risk. And I think that's not really going to cut it. on the positive side, I think we can be enormously grateful to English liberalism and also to thinking from the Enlightenment and so on, because it has enlarged our vision in many respects of justice, of how people can live fairly with each other. Many of the political concepts are utterly basic to who we are as a people. And so it's, as most things in life, a situation where there are pluses and minuses. But why I've asked you to read Hauerwas and then Niebuhr, material which is exceedingly strange to some of you, is that I think if you're really going to understand the world in which we live, you need to have some exposure to material like that, and also, and probably primarily, because I think many of the ideas are simply very exciting ideas, and they're worth thinking about. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. We never turned. I thought. I'm sorry. That was never turned on. Those are the two synopsis questions. I had a glitch getting these printed out today, and so at least get the questions for next week in case you want to work on them. Yes, it's an either or. Do A or B, and I'll get the sheets to you on Tuesday. I don't like this to happen, but once in a while you have something unforeseen come up. So write on either A or B for the synopsis question. Carl? Is that next week that the draft is due of the paper or the prospectus? Okay, what we decided to do when the TAs and I got together on Tuesday, we decided to not have those handed in here in class, but hand them in your discussion section next week, your prospectus for your papers. Give them to your discussion section leader or myself for my section next week. Thank you, Carl.